So Acts chapter 17, we're going to be looking at verses 16 through 34, which is the last part of the chapter. And we're going to do a study on Paul and his particular way that he delivered the gospel message in Athens. So let's look at Acts chapter 17, verse 16 through 34, and I'm going to read those and then we're going to talk about them. Sort of go verse by verse. This is going to be a two-part thing. The first one, I'm going to try and stay on track to where I am just talking about what Paul is going through, and then the next time we're going to talk about what we're going through as far as it relates to the Athens at that time. So give me 1 second. I know you can't see this, but it will help me when I'm doing the teachings. All right, Acts chapter 17, verse 16. Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols. Therefore he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshippers, and in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. Then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign gods, because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore we want to know what these things mean." For all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus, you might have Mars Hill, depends on which version you're using, and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Therefore the one whom you worship without knowing him I proclaim to you, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life and breath and all things. And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and their boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. Truly, these times of ignorance God overlooked, but now commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he has ordained. He has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, while others said, 'We will hear you again on this matter.' So Paul departed from among them. However, some men joined him and believed, among them Lyrnesus, the Areopagite, a woman named Damaris, and others with them." So we've just read it, and now we're going to talk a little bit about it. We're going to go back to verse 16. The title of the message would be "A Profound Gospel from a Personal God." And let's look at verse 16. "Now while Paul waited for them in Athens, the spirit was provoked within him when he saw that the city was given over to idols." And let's try and visualize what's taking place and how Paul has gotten there and what he's up against at this time. And if you know anything about the Athenian history, it was pretty much given over to idols. It was a place, everywhere you turned, there were statues, there were images, there were whatever you could think of. They named it as a god, and they built a statue for it, and then they considered that statue that god. This was on Paul's second missionary journey. He was waiting on some other fellow missionaries. Paul was going from city to city, and every time he preached the gospel, he was always being persecuted, so he would move on to another city, and he continued on doing those same things. So in Athens, he's there now, and the first thing that he does is he just looks around and he sees the type of people. Like I'm doing tonight, I'm looking around and I see all different types of people. But Paul started seeing a lot of other things as well. He started seeing maybe restaurants. He started seeing what we would say were churches. And the thing that grabbed his heart and the thing that he really latched onto was he saw all these statues, all these images of all these foreign gods, of all these false gods. And within Paul's heart, I'll give you some of the meanings. The situation is total idolatry. Paul was provoked. He was stirred. He was painfully excited. He was deeply troubled, and he was greatly distressed. So it wasn't just like, look at all these people and look at all these images and, well, what am I going to do? It was actually a pain in his heart that he needed to do something about this because he knew that a false god can't help anybody. So he had to be very open to the Spirit of God, that his spirit was being connected to God. So now what is he going to do? Well, now he's going to do some certain things. And what we're going to talk about tonight is how Paul approached these Greeks, these Gentiles. How many of us in this room are Jewish? Nobody, okay. So all of us are Gentiles. And don't take that as a derogatory remark, we're all Gentiles. Basically, all that means is you're not a Jew. In the scriptures, it makes a distinction between two classes of people. We'll get into that, the race issue, in a little bit. But two classes of people, either you were a Jew or you were a Gentile or a Greek. And that's how the scriptures determine people. So Acts 17, verse 17. Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshipers, and in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. So now, his spirit's being stirred. He's provoked. It doesn't say that he's angry. It just says that he's very distressed. He's very troubled. If he was angry, that would be a good thing because the Bible says for us to be angry for God because God is a holy God. He's a righteous God, and there's no other gods besides him. So if you see an image of another false god, that's going to make us upset as believers, which is sort of what I was going through for the last 2 days. So let's look at it. One of the key words in verse 17 is to reason. And some of the translations do it as dispute, debate, argue, discuss, or preach. So all of those things are what Paul is trying to accomplish. He starts off in the synagogue. And one of the reasons he would start off in the synagogue, what would be a reason? It would be pretty obvious for Paul. He was a Jew. So he goes to what he called his kin, his relation first, and he starts there. And the reason why he starts there is because they already have the Old Testament. They already have the truth, and all he has to do is just proclaim Jesus and the resurrection, which is what he was doing in the Scriptures. So he goes to the synagogue first, and he disputes with them. He debates with them. And if you look at the book of Acts, you see what has taken place every time Peter or Paul or even Stephen or any of the apostles started mentioning about Jesus and the resurrection. There was always persecution, so they had to move from town to town. So Paul knows that when he goes into the synagogue, he's going to start something already. It's sort of like us. We know something's going to happen, but we know that we need to do it anyway. And we know that if we do it anyway, then there's going to be repercussions and there's going to probably be persecution. So Paul does it anyway. He goes to the Jews first and also says to the Gentile worshipers. We have some examples of the Gentile worshipers. Some of them would be like Rahab. She was converted. Even though she was a Gentile, she was converted to Judaism. They call her a proselyte. So we have examples in the scriptures of people who are Gentiles, but they forsook the idols and the false gods, and then they went to the true God. So we see those examples. So he's talking to those, and then he does something that's unique to Paul at that time, but it shouldn't be unique to us in this day time. Verse 17 says, in the marketplace daily with those who happen to be there. What that means is, and I thought this was one of those things that just wakes you up, because what this means is you have to get out there into the highways and the hedges. You have to get out there into the world. The synagogue, that's a safe place. They're religious people. You can talk about religious things in a religious setting. We're in the church tonight, and I feel pretty free to talk about Jesus Christ and the scriptures and about religion or whatever issue I may have. In the marketplace, it's totally different. There's a way that you talk to people. You have to observe people. You have to find out where they're at. And the biggest thing is you have to get out of your comfort zone. So Paul, he forsook everything. He forsook his feelings. He forsook what he thought would be safe for him. He did exactly what God told him to do, but even though he not necessarily wanted to do that. So Paul stepped out of his comfort zone. He went to the marketplace daily, and he reasoned with them. He preached the gospel to them. He debated with those people. If you've never been in a debate, I don't know if I would encourage you to be in a debate, but it's one of those things that unless you've been in one, You have no idea what it is, especially we have different debates, political debates. We have social debates. We have cultural debates. But when you talk about a religious debate, people can get heated. People can get upset about those things because that's one of those things that is supposed to be private. And I don't want to be coming out in the open with my Christianity because you might be a Muslim and I don't want to offend you. So we have to be very careful and we have to be ready to give an account. And we have to not worry about what's going to happen to us. So this is what Paul's doing. And if you read the rest of the book of Acts and even up to this point, you see what Paul went through. And you're reading the letter, you really don't understand what it's talking about. Well, Paul was beaten. I mean, he was close to death on so many different occasions. He was turned away by so many different people. He had friends to forsake him. And why are we not preaching the gospel? Will we ever go through anything like Paul had went through at that time? Probably not, not in America anyway. In some of the other nations we will. So he reasoned daily in the synagogue with the Gentile worshipers and in the marketplace. Verse 18, now we're getting two new groups of people coming into play. And these people are what's going to determine the rest of this body of scripture that we're reading. And we're going to see that they had some twisted views that in that time were weird, and in this time of day, they're weird. And like I said, this is going to be a two-part series. So next week, you're going to find out why this belief that we're going to talk about in this next verse is still here for today. Verse 18, then certain Epicurean and Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, what does this babbler want to say? And we'll stop right there. Again, if I had my PowerPoint, you would see this. So I'm going to read it to you. The Epicureans, they were a certain class of people, and they emphasized the neutrality of the gods. And just notice that I said gods, plural. And on my PowerPoint, I have lowercase g. They rejected immortality and mysticism, and they had no afterlife. This is what they believed. This is what they taught. The highest order of man, this is what man was to look forward to. This is what man was to strive for, and this was one's own pleasure was the greatest good. And basically, this was modern-day humanism or materialism, and we'll talk about that next week. Epicurus was the founder of Epicureanism, and this is his riddle. And I wish I had it on the PowerPoint, but I don't, so pay attention to it. My voice is raspy tonight, so I'll probably repeat this twice. But this is his riddle, and just think about the situation that we're in America today. This is his riddle. If God is willing to prevent evil, but is not able to, then he is not omnipotent. If God is able but not willing, he is malevolent. If God is both able and willing, then where does evil come from? If God is neither able nor willing, then why call him God? Let me read it one more time just to make sure. And this was a riddle written back almost 2,000 years ago. Well, actually further than that. If God is willing to prevent evil but is not able to, then he is not omnipotent. If God is able but not willing, he is malevolent. If God is both able and willing, then where does evil come from? If God is neither able nor willing, then why call him God? So this is the foundation of Epicureanism. And that's a scary thought to think that that's what they believed back then. And you'll find out next week that there are a lot of people who believe that today. And we'll deal with that. So that's who the Epicureans were. And they were one side. There were about four different philosophies in Athens at that time. These were the two main ones. So these are the two that we're going to deal with tonight. Stoicism. And this is the beliefs of Stoicism. Believe the universe is a material known as God or nature. And it was basically a pantheism. Everything is God. God is in everything. Everything's in God. This is what they believe. They relied on fate, not faith, fate, or universal reason. A lot of times today we'll hear people say, well, it's just fate that this is going to happen. Well, fate brought me this far. Well, fate brought you into my life. And this is where it came from, is the Stoicism. They strived in life for one thing, in which was virtue was to live in accordance with nature. They They threw away their bodies. They did not want to have anything to do with their bodies. They punished their bodies. They believed that their bodies were evil. The main goal for them was to live in harmony with nature. They had things in common. It's hard to believe that they did, but these are the things that they had in common. The first thing is, and this is what Paul is dealing with when he gets to this certain place that we're going to talk about, they denied a personal creator God. And that was the first point that Paul's going to deal with. The second thing is they didn't believe in a resurrection of any type, whether it was Jesus' resurrection or the resurrection of anybody's body. They did not believe. Now, this is both the Epicureans and the Stoics. Both of them believed in a plurality of gods. The Epicureans basically said that if the gods are real, then the gods have their hands off of everything. They don't do anything. The Stoics said that the gods are real. There's a plurality of numerous thousands, millions of gods, and we have to please all of those gods, which means I can't please myself. I have to please those gods. And the Epicureans were a little bit backwards or reversed from the Stoics. They wanted to please themselves and forsake the gods, even though they believed in the gods. They continually desired new philosophy. And we'll talk about philosophy in a minute. Philosophy basically means seeking wisdom and knowledge. It's a continual seeking wisdom and knowledge. The verse that I came up with was 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23. So when we preach that Christ was crucified, the Jews are offended, and the Gentiles say it all nonsense. Okay, so let's go to verse 19. Now we're getting a little bit of a detail of why the Epicureans and the Stoics, these philosophers, and philosophers meant that they were smart, they were very intelligent as far as the teachings that were in that day. So these were not what we would call idiots or fools, well, we would call them fools today, but these are not uneducated people. They are very educated people. They are the top people within their community. They are the philosophers. And we're going to talk about where they go and why they go in a little bit. So the issue with Paul was, what do you think their issue with Paul would be? All right, you're taking too long. The main thing is he preached one God, only one God. And we can see that he was already preaching this because he was in the marketplace, which causes the philosophers to come to him. He didn't go to the philosophers, they came to him. And now he's saying, well, this is why I'm preaching what I'm preaching. So he preached a one God, a personal God. Remember, the title of this message is a personal God delivering a what did I even say? Let's see.
Profound gospel.
A profound gospel. Okay. He's going to keep me on track tonight. Okay. So the personal God. And if you think about us in Christianity, and I don't like to call it a religion because I have a relationship with this personal God. But if you look at us and you look at all the other religions out there, and again, I use Christianity not as a religion, none of them have what they call a personal God. None of them. The Muslims don't. Not even the Mormons, they don't. I mean, they have a little fuzzy feeling within their spirit or whatever they want to call it, but they don't even have a personal relationship. The Hindus definitely don't. So we're going to talk about all of this. But no other religion has a personal relationship with a personal God. And Paul goes on, and he doesn't just stop with a personal God, but he says a creator God that created everything basically from nothing because he wanted to. The Epicureans and the Stoics basically believed in a type of evolution that space, time, matter has always existed and it's going to continue to exist. Things just transform basically what evolution teaches. So that's what they were talking about. The other issue is that Paul preached about a resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus Christ, which makes our God separate from all other gods. No other God has ever raised himself from the dead. No other God says that he's still living today. No other religion actually has the evidence that we have for the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So this is why the Epicureans, all these philosophers are coming up against Paul, because Paul had the evidence and they didn't like what he was talking about. It was a new thing, but they didn't like it. Verse 19, and they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak. Now, the Areopagus was basically, there were two gods. Well, actually, it was one god. One was, let me go ahead so I can keep it right. He was called Ares in the Greek. And he was called, does anybody know what he was called in Roman times? And the King James is actually translated as Mars Hill. So Mars is the Roman equivalent of Ares, which is the Greek god. And he was basically the god of war, of frenzy, of hatred, and bloodshed. And if you notice, all the Greek gods, they were always about what we would call natural disasters or something natural that has taken place. Again, on my PowerPoint, I had a list of all the Greek and Roman gods. Zeus, which is his counterpart, is Jupiter. Hera, Juno, Poseidon. How many know of Poseidon? Poseidon's adventure, the water god. The Roman times, he would be Neptune. Demeter, Ceres, Hestia, Vesta, Aphrodite. How many has heard of her? Venus would be her equivalent. Apollo, and then that's the same in both Roman and Greek gods, Apollo. Ares and Mars, the same thing. Artemis and Diana. Diana is one of those other goddesses that is mentioned. Paul had to deal with her and their worshipers. Athena and Minerva. I thought that was interesting because we had a cat that was named Minerva, and I never knew where the name came from. So that's where it came from. Okay, so that's some facts for us. The Areopagus basically meant the Hill of Ares or Mars Hill. It was a rocky place within Athens that sat high above everything else. And this is where the city council, basically, they went up top and they met and they talked about all those new things that were going on. So they sat up there and they would listen to the new things coming in. And if they liked it, then you were able to go around the city and continue to preach your message, your doctrine, your teaching. If they didn't like it, well, you were escorted out of the city, never to talk again. And now that I'm giving this background, this is going to start to make sense once we get down to verse 32, 33, and 34 of the book of Acts, chapter 17. And you're going to see, well, that's why Paul did what he did. Well, that's why Paul didn't go no further than what he did. So we're going to see that. All right. Verse 20. For you are bringing some strange things to our ears, therefore we want to know what these things mean. Strange things. In the Greek, does anybody know what that means? You'll laugh. Okay. It means unusual or strange. That's all it means. So, Paul is preaching a message that they've never heard before. And you can think about our tribal nations that are still out there, these tribes who have, people would say they have never heard the gospel before. They've never heard about Jesus Christ before. So Paul's in that situation. He's in Athens, and he's got people who have never heard about Jesus Christ, let alone the resurrection of Jesus Christ or the resurrection of human beings. So now he's there. And so now he's on top of the Areopagus. He's up there on the hill. He's around all of these people, and they're asking him, well, what's this new teaching? What's this strange doctrine that you're bringing forth? We want to hear more about this. The philosophers are telling us, now we want to weigh these things, if they're true, if they make sense to us, and then we'll decide whether or not you're going to go through the city and proclaim your new teaching. Verse 21, for all the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. So this is all they spent their life doing. You got something new to tell me? I want to hear it. What you got? You got something new? Come on over here and tell us about it. Just the same old message. It's not going to do me any good. I need something new. I need something fresh. Something that's going to change my life. And it sort of made me start thinking about Oprah Winfrey's book club. It's something new. It's something fresh. It's something that's going to change your life. And then once you get done reading the book, it doesn't change your life. You need another book. So it was just a continual thing. It was a cycle. They were never changed. They were never satisfied. They were always looking for something new. And again, think about what we're going to be talking about next week. It's the same culture, and we're going to be talking about that. The climate of the Areopagus was a philosophy seeking wisdom and knowledge. Philosophy is different than theology or actually searching for the truth. Philosophy is just building up wisdom and knowledge. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing neither. So we need to make that distinction. Somebody can be a philosopher and know everything about all the gods and yet still not be a believer. And somebody can be a believer who knows nothing about any of the other gods besides the one true living God, and yet that's the correct position. So philosophy doesn't always make you a genius or somebody that somebody else should be following after. Excuse me. Verse 22, then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, And now he's going to start proclaiming the message that he was proclaiming in the marketplace. But he's going to start with a premise. And he's already been looking around their city. And he's already seen all the idols and the images. And he's already seen these things that are grabbing at his heart and causing him pain and causing him sorrow. And now he's going to use those things as an illustration. If you notice, Paul does not go back to the Old Testament and proclaim in the beginning God necessarily. He's going to use some abstract presentations that the Athenians, that the Epicureans, that the Stoics, that the philosophers knew what he was talking about, and he's going to turn those familiar things around into proclaiming the gospel. And Paul was one of those people. I mean, we look at Peter and we look at all the other apostles and the disciples and the deacons at that time and how they preached the gospel. Paul was very unique. I mean, the hand of God was upon him. And we have to appreciate how Paul did these things and the manner in which he proclaimed the gospel. So now he's proclaiming this message. Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. He was not there to defend himself necessarily. He was basically to tell them this new thing. Remember, the Areopagus or the city council was looking for new things. They were the yay and nay, if you want to say it like that. If they said yay, you could go around the city and you could proclaim your gospel freely. If they said nay, you couldn't speak with their blessing. Of course, Paul could do it anyway. He knew the repercussions and he was ready to take those things. So he's going to talk about his new religion. He's going to be looking at those things. Very religious. King James says superstitious, very religious. Darby, I like his translation. And the original Greek, you can actually come up with this. It's sort of in your face, so I don't think Paul necessarily would have said it in that way. But this is what Darby said. Given the demon worship. Now, if you can imagine Paul up around the city council when he's saying, men and brethren, I see that you are very religious, then change that. I see that you are given to demon worship. You're just a bunch of evil people. And I don't think Paul came across like that, even though you can translate it like that. I would agree with Darby in a way. The original Greek has actually got the root word for demon in there, so that may be where Darby got it from. So they were too superstitious. They were very religious. They were a people that were given over to the gods, whatever the gods were. And now he's going to proclaim this unknown God. Verse 23, for as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Now, this is a city full of idolatry. You got the Greek and the Roman gods. They're also incorporating other little bitty gods, lesser gods. Let's look at details on the unknown God, because this stands out. And again, this will be on the PowerPoint. Here goes the details. In addition to the 12 main gods in Athens and the innumerable lesser gods or deities, ancient Greeks, I keep on having something popping up on my computer, so bear with me. Nothing dirty or anything. Okay. Ancient Greeks worshipped a deity they called Agnostos Theos, which is basically the Greek for the unknown God. In Athens, there was a temple specifically dedicated to the God, and very often Athenians would swear in the name of the unknown God. The unknown God was not so much a specific deity, but a placeholder for whatever God or gods actually existed, but whose name and nature were not revealed to the Athenians or to the Hellenized world at large. Hellenized basically means Greek or un-Jewish nations is what it means. And I got that from Wikipedia. Okay. Some other details about it was this unknown God, they had a plague at one time, and basically they sacrificed to this unknown God because Zeus couldn't handle it, Poseidon couldn't handle it, Ares couldn't handle it. None of the other gods could take care of this plague. So they sacrificed to an unknown God, and all of a sudden the unknown God takes care of the plague, and now the unknown God's there. So that's one of the other options of how the unknown God came. So now he sees an altar to an unknown God with the inscription, and or the unknown God on there. And Paul, that's probably what troubled him even more than anything else, is to see that. And he knows who Zeus is. And that would bring up another point, philosophy. Paul was a well-educated man within Judaism, and to know all of the other Greek gods and the Roman gods and to be able to talk about those as freely as he did, he had to be educated in their philosophies as well. So not only was he a Jew of Jews, a Pharisee, but he was also well-educated in all of these other religions at that time. If you can see how he was working as he traveled from city to city, he was able to defend the one true God against these other gods. It was probably his education. It was probably the Spirit of God on him too, because we know that the Spirit of God speaks through us. So he was probably moving in both ways. Let's go on. Verse 23, continuing. So therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing him, I proclaim to you. And basically, he's talking about this ignorant worship and how they were worshiping a God that they didn't know. And in reality, they did know him. They were basically blinded and they didn't want to see him, because Paul had already been to the marketplace and the synagogue, and he had already proclaimed Jesus Christ and the resurrection. So they had already heard about him up until that point, not in great detail, but they had heard about him. So now Paul's going to go into detail about who this unknown God is. Romans 1 talks about ignorant worship, how people, they worship the creation more than the Creator, and in the end they're going to be without excuse. So now Paul's telling these people, and we're going to get into that. All right, let's go on to verse 24 before I get into the other stuff. Verse 24, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. God who made the world and everything in it. He starts back all the way to the beginning. He doesn't jump off at the cross. He doesn't jump off at the resurrection. He sees these people. They really don't have a grasp. They're really ignorant of this unknown God. So he says, let me take it back. Let me bring you all the way through it, and let's show you who I'm talking about. So this God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, Lord basically means ruler, owner. He can do what he wants and how he wants. Does not dwell in temples made with hands. Now remember, the city is consumed with idolatry. There's statues everywhere. I can't even really think of a nation that would be compared, besides maybe an Indian nation where they're predominantly Hindu, something like that. Maybe some of the Spanish nations where they are consumed with Catholicism and they have all of these statues and these icons and these things that they're bowing down to. That would be the only thing that would probably come close to what Athens looked like at that time, is to see all of those idols, all of those graven images. So now Paul is telling them, this God, this unknown God, he's not a graven image. He's not this altar that you're bowing down to. He's the one true God, the living God, the creator of all the heavens and the earth. And he is Lord of all, which means he controls all. Now remember, Epicurean and Stoic philosophy was, the Epicurean said, if there is a God, they're hands off. The Stoics said there is gods, but they relate to us, and then again, they might not relate to us. It just depends on how the gods feel that day. So this is what Paul was coming up against. He was telling them there's a one true God, there's a creator God, and he's Lord of all. He's actually dealing with his creation. He's not stepping back. He's not holding anything back. He's actually moving within his creation. So let's go on. It does not dwell in temples made with hands. Again, it goes back to those images or those temples. Even in our circumstances today, a lot of times we see Christian religions where they believe that God is inside the church, as far as this is God's house. When you come in, you need to be reverent to the building, because the building is where God dwells. And they have, you know, especially Catholicism, which really is one of those things that tugs at my heart, because you can see these beautiful, beautiful cathedrals, especially in Rome, the Vatican. If you've ever looked online at their actual homepage, you can see the Vatican there, and it's just awesome. I mean, it is one of those things that man made it, but you can't believe it, because it's just one of those things that's beautiful. And they believe that God's there.
they believe that God is with them at that time, but only within the Vatican, only within when the Pope is speaking ex cathedra. So we see, even in our society today, we have those things. And Paul's saying, God's not within those temples. He's not within those icons, within those statues. How many of you have come up behind a car and it's got a picture of what they would say either is a picture of Jesus Christ on the back of the glass, or what they would say is a picture of the Virgin of Guadalupe or the Virgin Mary, especially on the vehicles that Hispanics drive? I've seen it, definitely. And I had a Catholic friend. I grew up with him ever since kindergarten. I love him and pray for him every day because he's still lost. And every time we'd ride by the Catholic Church in Reeseville, and I would be in the back and his brother and him would be on this side. And as soon as you got near that Catholic Church, it was like that. You know why? Because that's the building. That's where their God is. And they're venerating and they're showing respect to their God. And they're doing like this. They're crossing themselves. I don't know how you feel about that, but that irritates me, because why do I need to cross myself when the Holy Spirit's inside of me? So these are the issues that Paul had with the Athenians at that day. That's my soapbox, so please forgive me for that. Okay. Verse 25, and we'll talk about those things next week more in detail. Verse 25, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And what he's saying right here is, God doesn't need anything. The Stoic gods, they needed for the people to please the gods. You had to bring these certain sacrifices. You had to make these idols. You had to make these statues. I'm going to have to cut it off, too. Okay. They made these statues, and this is my God. And if you remember back in the Old Testament, this is exactly what the Jews did. They made the calf, and they said, this is our God. This is what we're going to bow down to, and we're going to worship. And, of course, you realize that God got very angry with that. So God is very angry with anybody who makes up a false god and says, this is our God, when it's not the true God. So God is not a God who needs anything or even needs our worship. And a lot of times, certain Christian denominations get in trouble because they say that God needs us for something. God doesn't need us for anything. If he needed us for anything, that would actually answer Epicurus, his riddle. If God needs us, then why do we need God? And that would be my issue with it. So he's neither worshipped with man's hands as though he needed anything, since God gives life, gives to all life, breath, and all things. Now, he didn't just say human beings. He actually concluded with all of creation. This great God, this creator God, he gives to all things life and breath and all things. Verse 26, and we'll stop there. We'll finish up next week. Verse 26, and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. Some of the translations say of one man. And I used to have an issue with that, but I really don't have an issue with that any longer. I guess that was one of my legalistic tendencies. Blood and man is still referring to Adam. So I can't really have an issue with it anymore. So all of one blood. And if you notice that the gospel doesn't change for certain races, if you want to call them races, I don't. It doesn't change for different ethnic groups or different languages. The gospel stays the same. And Paul shows us in the book of Acts chapter 17, as far as it relates to the other chapters, that the gospel never changes, but the presentation does, depending on our situation and our circumstances. So we're all of one blood, every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined the preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. Basically, God has set a time, and he set a reason why this nation stands right now. And then this nation's going to fall at this time. And a lot of times we say, well, we have to be concerned about the politics and who we're going to vote for and what this president's going to do and what this president's going to do and what this Senate's going to do. And we're supposed to pray for our nation, of course, for our leadership, of course. And we're supposed to, if we got the freedom to vote, we need to exercise our rights to vote. But at the same time, if somebody who we don't like or their beliefs are not the same as ours, if they are voted in, who ordained it? And that's the way we have to look at it. God ordains it for a reason and for a purpose. It doesn't mean that God doesn't love us. It doesn't mean that God has taken his hand off of us. It just means that God has done something for a reason. One of the issues that I would bring up right now is, where is my home? Is it here or is it there? It's there. Am I a resident of earth or am I a resident of heaven? Heaven. I'm visiting earth. I am a sojourner, as Paul would say. I am an ambassador, as Paul would say. But this is not my home. Heaven is my home. The Bible says that we are as seated in heaven right now as we ever will be. Even though we don't feel like it, that's what the Scriptures say. So when I am out in the world, I need to act like I am a foreigner. I don't know necessarily if you would be a tourist, but you would be an, let's just say, ambassador, because that's what Paul said. You're there for a reason and a purpose. A lot of times tourists, they're just there to look at everything and say, ooh and ah, and, well, can I buy this and take this home? That's the truth. So. But an ambassador is there for a reason and a purpose. We're there to represent our nation. We have ambassadors that come from the United States over to all these other nations. We just had the Olympics going on. And we had ambassadors from our nation go over there and play the games. And they represented the United States. They won individual golds and so forth. But they were there representing the nation of the United States. We are here to represent Jesus Christ and his kingdom, which is not earthly, which is not made with men's hands, which is not to be destroyed by men's hands. So when we look at things and we see things that may rub us the wrong way, that may shake us a little bit, we can know with firm assurance, with confident assurance, that our God is not a weak God. And just take the picture of Paul. He probably had many scars. He was probably physically just very depraved, and you wouldn't think that he was a man that could do anything. This is a picture that I'm getting from everything that Paul went through. And to see him to stand up and in the prisons, being kicked out of wherever, out of the synagogues. This is my people. These are the people that I am physically related to closely, because we're all physically related to each other in Adam anyway, but physically related closely. And these are the people that are shunning our God. So just imagine if your family turns against you, if all of your friends turn against you, if you don't know if you're going to eat tomorrow, if you don't know if you're going to live tomorrow, if you're going to make it through the night without somebody persecuting you and chopping off your head and throwing your body into a boiling pot of oil or hanging you upside down and being crucified. And just to think that this can happen to me, but yet I'm going to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. And just imagine what we could do if we would just have a little bit of the Christian integrity that Paul had. That Paul would stand up and say, I'm not worried about what's going to happen to me because my home is not on this earth. I know where I'm going to go when I die, but I don't know where these Athenians are going to go when they die. I know what they believe. I know what they worship. And it's not the God that I'm proclaiming today. So am I going to take the chance and even offend them, even hurt them, even hurt their feelings, even turn them away from me? But am I going to take the chance to proclaim the gospel of the risen Savior, the Creator God, the Lord of all? Am I going to take this opportunity that God has placed before me? Am I going to do that? Or am I just going to close my mouth and walk out of the city as a tourist and maybe grab me an idol, maybe grab me a graven image, maybe get me some of their good ethnic food and never open up my mouth? Or am I going to basically destroy their idols, eat their food if you want to? As long as it's in faith, you can eat their food. That's what the Scriptures say. I'm trying to lighten everything up a little bit. So, but what are we going to do? And we'll talk about that tomorrow. Not tomorrow, but next week. The gospel that we proclaim, is it being effective? Can we be more effective in the gospel that we proclaim? The best way that we can be effective is by our lifestyle, and it has to start there. Paul came in, and he didn't have a Christian shirt on. He didn't have a Bible in his hand. He wasn't walking around and saying, repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand. He didn't say, turn or burn. But he came in there in a way that was different than the Athenians. They knew something was different about him. He proclaimed a message that was strange, that was new, that was exciting to them. Why is it different to me? And look at our society, and why is my life different than the unbeliever? Is it because I live a certain place, I talk a certain way, I work at a certain place? Or is it because I have the living God living inside of me? What makes me different from the unbeliever? And this is what Paul was telling them. I'm different from you not because I'm a Jew or a former Jew, not because I can speak all these different languages, not because I know anything but this one true God. And this is what Paul proclaimed. We'll finish up next week. I apologize for going over on time.